Blog Talk Radio.
Matthew Modine on working with Stanley Kubrick.
I felt like I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know how to play this character that Stanley Kubrick was giving me an opportunity to play, and I knew it was a really important film. I knew this was a really difficult character, maybe the most difficult character I'd ever played. And I was wandering around in a field, and I saw Stanley driving across it in his Jeep, and I tried to hide in the grass so he wouldn't see me. And of course he did, and he drove across the field and drove up and said, "Hey, you know, jump in, I'll give you a ride to the set." And I said, no, it's okay, I'll walk. And he could see that I was disturbed and upset, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Well, Stanley, I don't know how to play this role. I don't know what you want from me. I don't know what I'm doing." And he shut the Jeep off, and he pulled on his beard, and he scratched his forehead, and he said, "Listen, I don't want you to play anything. I just want you to be yourself." And I said, "Yeah, sure, Stanley. Okay, yeah. I'll just be myself." And he said, "Jump in the Jeep. I'll give you a ride to set." I said, no, it's okay. I'm gonna walk." And he drove off, and I wrote in my diary that I know the important part of that sentence was to be.
"I think I was trying to suggest something about the duality of man, sir."
"The what?"
"The duality of man, the Jungian thing, sir."
"Whose side are you on, son?"
You can hear the rest of Matthew Modine's interview on the Kubrick series, the Movie Geeks United in-depth 8-part tribute podcast dedicated to the films of Stanley Kubrick, airing Sunday, December 5th through December 12th. Hello, everybody. Movie Geeks United this Sunday night. Hope everyone out there has had a great weekend. Has yours been good, Jerry?
I think mine's been good. I mean, I felt like really kind of like a really test question there, and like if you didn't answer it right, you're going to get smacked. So, yeah, it was awesome. It was the best I've ever had. It was incredible.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I have a new phone. How does a new phone sound?
It sounds awesome. It sounds very good.
All right, good. I had to buy a conference phone with a couple, mm-hmm. with like two lines, because I'm trying to figure out how to call out internationally.
Mm-hmm.
So, because Blog Talk Radio, their switchboard doesn't allow you to do that. So I concocted a plan.
All right, good for you. Well, don't say it on the air, man. Don't say it on the air.
Yeah, but I got this elaborate plan, a conference call kind of thing, and I don't know how to use the phone. I can't figure it out.
Okay, all right, fair enough.
I'm such a technological idiot, really. But,
Welcome to the club.
I guess I got to read the instructions.
Yeah, I think you'll have to on that one, especially for the international ones.
We're living in a world where you need instructions to use a telephone.
I don't know, man, but international, dude, that's awesome. We can talk to Isabella Huppert and Fanny Ardant. And Stephanie Audrey. We talk to all the French actresses I love, and not understand a word they're saying.
Yeah. Hey, did you see that Morning Glory this weekend?
Yes, I did.
I wanted to see it. I obviously didn't. I wanted to see it mostly for Harrison Ford, who looks hysterical in it for me.
Mm-hmm. It ain't Working Girl.
Well, I didn't quite like Working Girl.
Oh, really? I love Working Girl. I actually thought that was one of, like, when he enters, his entrance in the movie is that's like one of my favorite Harrison Ford performances outside of the iconic roles. I really like that performance a lot.
I mean, I can tell it wants to be a cross between Working Girl and Broadcast News without the intelligence of either.
It ain't even in the switching channels. Maybe more like that than
Really.
I'm saying we're switching channels is just an updated version of the front page, but no, it's Rachel McAdams' show all the way, and if she wasn't in it, you would probably walk out of the theater. Harrison Ford's all right, but he's like playing, I guess, this version of himself lately, this curmudgeon.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's just, it's all right. I mean, it's really, dude, it would be. Wait for it to come on cable. Well, get your money's worth out of your cable. Get your money's worth out of HBO. I don't know. It's all right. It's nothing. Like I said, she really makes it worthwhile. You're really latched. Imagine it's a successful version, if you will, of that movie Postgrad that came out last year with Alexis Bledel. It's like a successful version of that.
There's a glowing recommendation right there.
Yeah, but that's what it really is. Reminded me more of anything else was that movie, really.
I don't know if we announced it or not about the Criterion coming out with Broadcast News.
Is that in December, or?
That's in January, yeah.
January, that's awesome. That's great. Cool.
Yeah. When James L. Brooks was not afraid to make an R-rated movie.
Yeah,
no. What's this stuff? How do you know the new film he has? And they're going back and forth about the R rating in it. Strikes me as a movie for adults. You know, that kids
don't
want to see. Mm-hmm. What's this fear of the R rating? It's not going to limit its gross potential because it's clearly an adult romantic comedy kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't understand that because they've shown that you can have an R-rated movie and make a lot of money. So I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, it's discouraging. But I saw, what did I watch? I watched Cyrus last night.
I like
finally
Cyrus.
Got to see Cyrus. I liked it too. I thought I laughed out loud about four or five times in it, and I thought it was equal parts amusing and disturbing. It's
amusing and disturbing.
It's that uncomfortable comedy, you know, that I dig in the Larry David school of uncomfortable comedy.
Right.
And then I rewatched some old movies. Let me tell you, Encore is great. I like set my TiVo overnight, and I record all these old movies. And I watched Someone to Watch Over Me, the Ridley Scott movie, which I'd seen years and years and years ago.
Oh, God, I haven't seen that in so long.
It's good. I liked it. As I take a sip of water, I liked it. It was, I liked the contrasts in it between the very simple contrast, the high society woman, the gutter cop. His home life seemed really realistic between he and Lorraine Bracco, Tom Berenger and Lorraine Bracco. I don't see the major flaw in it is I don't see why on earth she would be attracted to him and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. True. Black Rain was on last night, actually. It's funny you bring that up because Black Rain was on one of the HBO or Cinemax channels last night.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I didn't like that. I've only seen that once. Opening weekend, I didn't care for it. I haven't given it another chance.
It's all right. I liked it. I watched it actually after Q&A. I got home from Q&A and watched it. And I just remember...
You got home from Q&A? Were they showing it somewhere?
I saw Q&A. No, this is when it originally came out, because I watched Black Rain on videotape.
Oh,
it didn't play.
Okay.
Black Rain did not play long enough to go see in the theater. I wanted to see it, and I just never got around to it. And... remember, Ridley Scott was not always a bankable director.
Right.
He was always considered like a visionary, but from Blade Runner and Legend and Black Rain and Someone to Watch Over Me, these movies did not do well.
Right.
He was really more of a critical, but people liked him. I mean, he had something going for him. It's not, was it Thelma and Louise that really kicks his career into box office stratosphere.
Yeah. I mean, he at the time of their release, he's had a couple of sizable hits.
Yeah.
And his movies gain more of a cult status than anything. But
that's
obviously
true.
Alien, Thelma and Louise, Hannibal, which that had a built-in appeal to it.
Yeah.
And then he has something like Kingdom of Heaven that just...
Kingdom of Heaven, which is, I need to watch the director's cut of that, but I hear that's really good. But what did he do? Like, I think, was it 1492, The Conquest of Paradise, which I think is really his lowest point.
And of course, Gladiator was a huge success.
Oh, Gladiator was the thing that really. But is it before Gladiator? He does G.I. Jane at some in 97.
Right.
Yeah. So.
He does high profile movies, and maybe 40% of the time they perform. But And I think the movies of his that do perform are generally the ones that are his best films.
True. Very true.
I mean, in this latter part of his career, anyway.
Oh, without a doubt. And speaking...
Matchstick Men did reasonably well.
Matchstick Men. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah,
I like
go
that
ahead.
Movie.
Speaking of
his brother's movie this weekend, Unstoppable, opened.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of fun. That is a really... Well, I think it's their best collaboration, Scott and Washington, since Man on Fire, personally. And I really
so too.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think
it's one of his best. I think it's one of his top fives.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it.
Good.
Yeah, no, I don't know what else you could say about it. I mean, it does what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, and it's a 90-minute thrill ride, and it doesn't let up. It's a feat
of short.
It's
the right length. It doesn't go on for like 2.5 hours. It does what it has to do. There's no fat in the film, which I found incredible, because some of these films you see is like 2.5 hours, 3 hours. They're like, we don't need that really.
Yeah, I also have the new Mike Lee movie here. I haven't watched yet. I'll be watching it tomorrow night, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. That looks good.
What's your favorite Mike Lee?
I like Secret and Lies a lot, and I like Career Girls a lot, but I like Topsy Turvy. But what is that one? Is there one called All or Nothing? That was one of the bleakest ones.
Happy Go Lucky.
No, Happy Go Lucky's all right.
I wasn't saying that Happy Go Lucky was a bleak one.
No, but it isn't as. You know, she is, like, undeniably this happy spirit and everything, this sprite that, you know, refuses to look on the downside of life. It was such a different movie from him. But the driving instructor is this great foil for her, and their confrontation at the end is wonderful. It makes the whole movie worthwhile, regardless of it. It's just that their confrontation between the two of them is incredible. And as our Dean Treadway, Life is Sweet is very good, too.
Would you say that he's one of the best writers of female characters?
One of them. We have several out there that are just phenomenal. Woody Allen, Pedro Almodovar, Cameron Crowe.
Right.
I mean, we got a lot of great.
But I do notice, because Woody Allen comes up a lot, and Pedro obviously comes up a lot, but you don't hear Mike Lee mentioned a lot. And then he's written a lot of very meaty roles for actresses in his films throughout his career. And yet the great American directors that we discuss, oftentimes that's a weakness of theirs, like a Scorsese or the directors that you think more testosterone driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mike Lee also Naked, the one with David Thewlis, is just incredible. Mm-hmm. That's an awesome film.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So we have good shows coming up. Wednesday night we have actress Olivia Williams. This year, her high-profile performance was in
The Ghost Rider,
the new Polanski film, and she's getting Oscar buzz for that, and so she's going to be on the show to talk to us about that. And she's been in a wide range of films, Sixth Sense, and Education.
Rushmore.
Yeah, all over
the place. And the show Dollhouse, she was very good on that. She's incredible. She's a very good actress.
And we were bragging on her on The Ghost Rider. I mean, everyone's very good in that, but she's that's the performance right there in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we have Dave Foley, comedian actor Dave Foley. He has a new DVD out for the holiday season called Cooper's Christmas. Oh, man. One of my blinds just fell off and hit me in the head. I'm sorry.
Dude, what the hell is going on over there?
We're going to be discussing that and the rest of his career. And then we have from Another Year, which is Mike Lee's new movie, Leslie Manville, who's getting lots of buzz for her performance in the film, and Jim Broadbent, who's also in Topsy Turvy for Mike Lee, and
he's in a lot of his films. And from the trailer I saw the other day, I agree with Dean. I'm sure it's not bleak at all, because it doesn't look bleak from the trailer. It looks very different from Mike Lee, to be honest with you. It doesn't look like the British work. I mean, one sense of British working class, but a very different take on it.
Right.
So it looks fascinating, though. It's a very funny trailer, actually. So you don't think, before Happy Go Lucky, you don't really think of Mike Lee in funny, but maybe he has. He's taking a different different track here. So it should be interesting.
I'll let you guys know on Wednesday night.
That sounds good.
So we also have, and then we're going to take a break. That's so we can come back December 5th for the Kubrick series.
Okay, so how long is our break for, just so I...
What is next Sunday, the 21st? Is that,
next Sunday, I believe, is the 21st, right.
Our break will either be the 21st or after the 24th. I don't know yet.
We usually always, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, we always take off. So we should probably do a show next Sunday take a break. So we should.
That's right. That's right.
We should probably, next Sunday will be it until, and then we'll have Stanley Kubrick Overdrive, which will be awesome.
Yes. Well, I guess that now's a good time to tell people about the Kubrick series. As it's shaping up, there's a website, moviegeeksunited.net, and it takes you directly to the Kubrick series. Look at it in Internet Explorer if you can.
What? Now, let me ask you this. Is that just something you found out by accident, or?
Yes. It's like I built the website,
mm-hmm.
and I looked at it through Firefox, and I was like, the design is all off, and I can't hear the sound files that I put in here. And then I just so happened to be at work, and I put it up on Internet Explorer, and it was all there. So I don't know. Different browsers.
Well, good in Chrome, Google Chrome. Do you use Google Chrome?
No.
Okay, it looks great now.
I'm looking
at it right now, and I'm going to put a link in the chat room. And it looks great, dude. I mean, you did an awesome job with this.
Well, thanks, man.
No, I mean, you really did an awesome job with.
Well, let me bring it up, because I got to read the guest list so far. It's some exciting stuff. I called because I've been trying to find people that were involved in his earlier works that I could get a hold of. So I called one such person who was actually in Paths of Glory, one of his earliest efforts. And people might know him best as the character of Oscar Goldman and the $6 million man, Bionic Woman.
Dude, I was just thinking about him last week. That's awesome.
Richard Anderson. So he's going to talk to us about the early Kubrick. Hang on. I'm bringing it up. Hang on. I gotta. Okay. So you'll be hearing from Matthew Modine, Leon Vitali, who was Kubrick's personal assistant and an actor in Barry Lyndon. Garrett Brown, the Steadicam inventor and the one that operated the Steadicam on The Shining, which was such an essential part of that film.
Right.
You'll also be hearing from a bunch of authors that have written extensively about Kubrick, including Vincent Labruto, Mario Falsetto, Randy Rasmussen, Stuart McDougall, that wrote a great book on A Clockwork Orange. Peter Biskin will be sharing his thoughts on his favorite Kubrick films, as will Peter Himes, who is the director of 2010 as well. So he had conversations with Kubrick. He had to get his assurances that it was okay with Kubrick for him to do 2010. Andy Armstrong, that's an interesting interview. He was the assistant director on Barry Lyndon. That was his first major gig.
Wow.
As an assistant director. Yeah.
I need to watch that again at some point. I haven't seen that in such a long time. Did you interview, by any chance, Frederick Raphael? Or?
No, I'd tell you why.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I brought up something bad for the sale.
No.
Okay.
I haven't even tried for Frederick Raphael.
Okay, because I have his book right here about Eyes Wide Open that I read a long time ago.
And I read it too. I read it when it first came out too.
Mm-hmm.
And the family and everyone close to Kubrick kind of demonized it.
I don't blame him.
Yeah.
I don't blame him at all.
So I was trying to stay clear of him.
No,
but that doesn't. that doesn't mean, it's good that you brought that up, that doesn't mean that this is going to be like an eight-part nonstop love fest, because part of what makes Kubrick so unique is the fact that he is so polarizing in some circles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You really either love his films or you don't, and there's very little in between there. So, ironically enough, Andy Armstrong, who was the assistant director on Barry Lyndon and has since gone off to be a stunt coordinator, he runs his own stunt unit, and we spoke to him Saturday when he had a break from the new Spider-Man movie.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't crazy about Kubrick or his experiences with him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting interview. And then there's also going to be, hopefully if it comes through, some critical back and forth between critics that love his movies and critics that don't like his movies. So we'll get both points of view on that. Dan Richter, who was an actor in 2001, is also part of the show. Alan Davia will talk about the photography in Kubrick's films. And Keith Ulick, our good buddy and critic for Time Out New York, is involved in all these episodes as well. And the guest list is growing every day. We've got another 2 weeks until we completely have to cut it off. What I'm not having any luck with is Malcolm McDowell. I can absolutely not get a response from his people.
I hope that's not because you kept playing that Halloween 2 clip a couple of years ago. I'm sorry. I'm sure it's not. But I mean,
D-E-A-D. Yeah. So I don't know. We're trying. We're
dude, it's awesome trying. So far. It's incredible. I mean, it's just wow. I mean, I never expected this. So this is awesome.
Well, hopefully it'll be good. And we'll be on. We'll also, all the movie geeks will be on, sharing their thoughts per episode, and then we'll be live the final episode to accept your calls and continue our conversation about the series, and we'll also be playing other remembrances of Mr. Kubrick and his unfinished projects, which I was contacted by someone that worked with him on Napoleon for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we get some great insights into that from him. So that's what's going on. If you guys have any questions or suggestions about the Kubrick series, shoot us an email at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, and we will get right back to you. What else is going on? I was going to say something. Okay. I'm going to air some dirty laundry here.
Shit.
Really not dirty laundry, but something that irks me very much.
Oh, God, okay.
And I don't mean to be... I don't mean to demean other Blog Talk Radio hosts when I say this. Honestly, I rarely talk about Blog Talk Radio hosts.
Mm-hmm.
But this irks me because you and I work so hard to get the talent that we get on the show. And we do our best to do great conversations with them one-on-one.
Yeah, no, you do an awesome job, yeah.
Well, we were all, yeah, I mean, we both. I mean, this is our show. And
yeah,
we put work into it. So, you know, we have been offered before the opportunity to either be in on a conference call where all the journalists, including Movie Geeks United, are asking questions, and I turn that down every time because I don't want to just get one question out and air that.
Right.
And what I don't want to do is air every other journalist interview with this person on our show.
Right.
I mean, that makes sense to me. And another part of it is I want us to work for whatever we do give to the people. Also, we've been offered audio recordings of press conferences that we're unable to attend in New York and L.A., which I've also turned that down for the same reason. I don't want to play everyone else's questions.
Right. I totally get that. I understand exactly where you're coming from because I feel the exact same way.
Yeah. It just doesn't seem to be playing fair. And when we say we've got whoever, Phil Donahue or Coppola, our listeners know that we've got them.
Right. Exactly.
So something's been going on Blog Talk Radio the past few weeks. There have been some new hosts coming up. I won't name names, but if you go to their website, their featured shows, you'll see a lot of big names. I mean, we're talking Denzel Washington,
Yeah, I've been seeing that too. Yeah.
Danny Boyle and Rosario Dawson and Edward Norton. Here's what they, and I've listened to every single one of them because, you know, if somebody works as hard as we do and they're succeeding, more power to them. That's great.
Right.
And I love competition, but I'm so competitive about this show.
We have to be. I mean,
but here's what's happening. They're taking the audio from those press conferences that they're given, and they're playing the answers. And you can tell that they're not asking the questions, that this isn't a one-on-one interview, because what they do is they say, and then I ask Denzel, what about blah, blah, blah? And then he plays the clip, and then the clip ends. And then we talk to Denzel about blah, 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 and then he plays the clip, playing it off like it's his interview.
Ooh, that's not good.
That pisses me off.
Not good at all.
And that's happening a lot on these other film shows. So just to let people know, I'm on top of it.
Okay, wow. I know. I had no idea. Wow. All right.
Yeah. It's cheating, man.
Yeah, that's just, I mean, if I was a listener, I would be upset. Because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's thinking, Jamie, just get off it, man. I know that. I mean, it's not something I lose sleep over, but I just kind of shake my head.
No, of course, no. I mean,
okay. Let's play a film score clip. You want to do that?
Yeah. What's the score?
And then we'll bring on Dean.
I like that. We'll play this clip, and then we'll bring on Dean. Yes, I love it.
Hang on, I have to find this file. Man, I've watched so many movies this weekend. None of them new.
That's all right. The only movie I can strongly recommend.
Superman 2.
Strongly recommend that you go see in a theater if you can when it comes to you. Is 127 Hours.
So you did see that?
Oh God, we got up early yesterday to go see it, and you know, to go to see the first show because it's only playing at one theater near us, so it's going to be packed, you know, as the day goes on. And oh, dude, it's well, I'll give you, if you know how my brain works, you should have known that I saw it yesterday because I posted the quote from Mad Max. This is Condolini, and Condolini wants his arm back.
I was wondering what, though, yeah.
No, that's the first thing I thought of in the infamous scene in 127 Hours as that starts. That's, of course, what your co-host thinks of, Mad Max. Oh, so it's a great movie. It's incredible.
That's what I've heard. Is it, I mean, it seems like a chore, man. I mean, because you're going to be watching somebody cutting their arm off.
It's not as bad as everyone's making it out to be. It is, I mean, literally, I turned away more from the screen during Saw than I did during this.
Okay,
it's not as bad. I think people are overplaying that, but that's beside the point. I'll say it again. James Franco, great actor, incredible, and especially in something like this, you need an actor who you are going to be watching for 96 minutes, someone that you care about, someone that you're like, hey, I want to watch him for that amount of time, and he's perfect.
Right.
Absolutely perfect. I'll be very honest with you. I think that he is a front runner right now for best actor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, without a doubt. I don't know what else is out there off the top of my head that's really been that powerful, but I think he's the front runner.
So Danny Boyle's direction in it, compared to the kind of the staccato, very quick cuts, the energy of Slumdog.
Well, that's there in some parts, especially the title credits in the beginning and also during, because when he's, you know, once he's trapped by the boulder,
mm-hmm.
we just can't have it where it's just him trapped with the boulder. We have these daydreams, what he's thinking about and everything. And so that's very, you know, has some of those cuts and everything. It's very good. It's Danny Boyle's direction. I the only two movies I have a problem with are The Beach and A Life Less Ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I think just A Life Less Ordinary because I think it's a weak follow-up to Trainspotting. The Beach, it even has nothing to even do with, even though at the time everyone thought Ewan McGregor would be in it because they had that partnership. It's just the book. I just had a totally different idea of what the movie, from my own perception of the book, that the movie didn't match that. That's really my main beef with the beach is that it's just like with any book to film adaptation, it's your perception, and it just didn't match what I was. The book had a huge impact on me when I read it, and but otherwise than that, I mean, I think he's a very versatile director. I know a lot of people don't like Sunshine. I love Sunshine, but it's really worthwhile.
That was a science fiction movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a science fiction. Speaking of Kubrick, and God, I gotta learn to open my mouth more when you ask these questions. You know, Sunshine is very influenced by 2001.
Mm.
I mean, I would say at least 60% of the film owes its existence to 2001.
Well, if Boyle and Aronofsky weren't tied up with their own press right now for their own movies, I would reach out to them. I mean, I already reached out about 127 hours, but
mm-hmm.
So we'll have to do without them. But you're right. I mean, I've read that about both of those gentlemen, mm-hmm. and I can't wait to see Black Swan. Black Swan.
Oh God!
True Grit. Yeah.
Oh my God! And I got to tell you the other two movies I'm looking for. Well, three movies I'm looking forward to, besides those two, which are high up. Somewhere, the Sofia Coppola one.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see The Tourist. I don't care what anyone says. I just think that looks like a cool film. But I really want to see The Fighter. I think I think that looks just incredible.
What I hear about The Fighter is Christian Bale is best supporting contender right there. That Christian Bale is phenomenal in it.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like another physical transformation role for him as well.
Oh, yeah. Like The Machinist? Yeah.
Okay, we're going to bring up Dean, one of our listeners. Anyone that listens to the show knows him and loves him. In about 4 minutes on the other side of this film score, this is from the new movie starring Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Billy Bob Thornton. It's called Faster.
Oh, cool.
And the score is by Clint Mansell. That's the movie Faster. It's Clint Mansell's score to that film. It's upcoming in theaters, starring Billy Bob Thornton and Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And here's our own Rock, Dean.
Hey!
No, man, it's The Rock. It's on our show. Awesome.
If only I had The Rock's money.
Yes.
I hear you, dude. I hear you on that.
Boy, that was is Clint Mansell the guy who does all the music for, like, Steven Soderbergh and stuff?
No,
yeah,
Aronofsky's main.
Oh, he's Aronofsky's, right. Okay, all right.
Well,
right.
No, Clint Mansell did Sex Lies. I mean,
he did Sex Lies, you're right.
Yeah,
but
this is out of the gate project.
Yeah.
Who was it that did score for Traffic?
I would think that was him. I think they're
was that him?
Regular.
Okay. Is he the guy? Didn't he used to be with Red Hot Chili Peppers or something like that?
I'll look this up because it's not. There is another.
Dean, we had no idea trivia was involved in your appearance.
Yeah,
tonight.
Jesus Christ, Dean! I have to do extra studying when I know you're going to be on. I mean,
well, I have another.
Aronofsky, though.
Uh-huh.
Wolverine 2, I think it sounds like from an article I read on Geeks of Dune, it's going to be kind of, they're going to sneak in a reboot, kind of. It's not, he's going to try to redeem, you know, the whole franchise because the first movie was so mediocre.
I hope they just don't call it Wolverine 2. Just call it something else entirely because that's ridiculous. Just, if they're going to.
Yeah, call it Edward
Scissorhands. Well, exactly. Yeah.
I like that. That's good, man. That's good.
That's a good idea.
So, Dino, what's on your mind, man?
Well, I had a pretty interesting thing happen this week.
Cliff Martinez.
Another Cliff. All right.
No,
sorry,
but
okay.
That and the soundtrack to The Limey are just so good. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Okay. That gets that in order in my mind. I had a one of the PR reps that I met from the New York Film Festival has been sending me a regular sort of like not really invitations but notations about things that are coming up at the New York at the Film Society at Lincoln Center.
Uh-huh.
And he sent a notice this week about something that's starting on November 19th, and I think goes through that week. I think it goes through the 26th. And it's a tribute to Golden Globus of Canon, you know.
Really?
Yeah,
film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, wow. So they have a list of the play-in John Frankenheimer's 52 pickup. As I think a movie called Roundabout by Nicholas Roeg.
Oh, that's great.
Street Smart with Morgan Freeman mm-hmm. and Chris Reeves by Jerry Schatzberg. Love Streams by John Cassavetes. Raul Ruiz version of Treasure Island. Let's see, a few other things too. A few
so
other,
they're
like,
leaving out his
things.
Hundreds of bad movies.
Well, they are. They are starting the. I was saving this for last. They are starting the festival off with probably the king canon bad movie of all time, which is The Apple. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen.
I know of it. I've never seen it though.
The Apple is the craziest movie, one of the craziest movies I've ever seen, and I've only seen it once and on VHS, and it was badly like panned and scanned, so it's a widescreen movie. So I'm really excited to see it on the big screen. It's a crazy movie that takes place in the future, which is in this movie that was made in 1980, is 1994, and there's this crazy Eurovision type of contest that's being won by this sweet little folk rock couple, and they get visited by a devilish character who tries to get them to sign a contract to sell their soul. And anyway, it's just the craziest movie I've ever seen. Like from costumes, dialogue is atrocious. The songs are really bad, but it's like one of those. It's one of the great bad movies. And
well,
so
his movies are like, if any retrospective of his work needs to include, like, midnight showings, because so many of his movies are great midnight movies. I mean, you think Invasion USA and all the Stallone stuff
and all the you know, Death Wish movies, like Death Wish
yes.
2 through 10 or whatever it was. So it's like,
but he's still around, isn't he? He's still kicking, right?
They're actually both going to be there. Both Golan and Globus are going to be there. So Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus are both going to be there on that opening night. And there's a few guests. So anyway, I got tickets to they're also showing. I got tickets to Love Streams or the Apple Street Smart, and also Jean-Luc Godard's King Lear with Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah, it was Woody Allen.
Yeah, right. So I got things for all four of those things, and so I thought I'd come on and tell you guys that I was going to this and see if we could get some discussion of canon movies out there.
Before we
get
on the canon, as it were, I think we have to on the show make a special mention of the passing of one of the great showman producers who passed away last week.
Well, this is true. I mean, this is a perfect segue.
I mean, I don't think we have anyone alive right now that is in the same... I'm not talking about quality, but there is some quality there, but just the outlandish nature of Dino De Laurentiis. He was in a class by himself. This is a guy, obviously, like Big Snakes. King Kong and Conan are no exact... But, no, obviously the early Fellini films.
I'm sure that I'll
Carlo
be in his eulogy.
But he really was... And Dune. Let's not forget the sandworms of Dune. He really had this thing
shot.
Phallic imagery.
I'll never forget that shot of... still in my mind. It's in my mind, even though I haven't seen that movie in years. But I'll never forget the shot in King Kong... of King Kong tearing that big snake in half, and just that snake's guts just sort of jumping out like in very rubbery looking and stuff.
Yeah.
But
we don't have
anyone
like him today.
No, not really. Not with the kind of his personality was as oversized as his movies could be. And he made no bones about it. You know, Roger Ebert posted or reposted an article that he did about he went to Bora Bora to cover the making of the remake of Hurricane back in '79.
I remember that movie. Yeah,
which was originally going to be done by Roman Polanski before Polanski got in another mess with his. With his legal troubles, and so
Polanski
anyway,
pulled out, so to speak.
Yeah, Polanski pulled out. Yeah, for once, and the Swedish director Jan Troell came in, and anyway, it's a really good article. The listeners can look it up on his blog, but it's an excellent article. That's really fun, and I would assume that more people have actually read that article than actually seen the movie that it's about. But
yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Dino De Laurentiis was amazing, you know. I mean, if you think that this is the guy that started off doing things like La Strada and Knights of Siberia with Fellini.
And he brought us the David Lynch that we all know and love, you know. I mean, he was behind Blue Velvet.
Yeah, that's
Lynch.
Right.
That's right,
yeah.
And then, you know, I don't think David Lynch would be where he is now without Dino De Laurentiis. And also, you think about things like Barbarella, and I like to lump these two movies together, Barbarella and Danger Diabolik.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good things to use. I mean,
those are two, you know, comic book flavored six cult movies that seem to go together really well. And then you think about, you know, him being a producer on things like Serpico and Death Wish and the Velocity Papers and things like that, you know. I mean,
right.
Just give me a sense of where you are, Dean.
Yeah, I want to know too. I'm curious as hell.
Really, what do you hear? I mean,
it sounds like you're near a drive-thru.
Are you in a park or something? Or?
No, but I'm walking down the street a little bit, and so there are people always passing and stuff, you know. But
okay.
No, I'm just walking down the avenue.
All right.
All right.
Right.
Fair enough.
I love. Anyway, the cannon thing, you know. What could you guys remember? Any other cannon movies that you know you think?
Well, I mean, their greatest contribution are the exceptional cameras that they produce.
Oh, man.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about doing a canon show, so maybe this will tie in well with that. So
yeah.
But after Kubrick, because, I mean, I've always wanted to approach those guys and see about getting them on the show. There's a comprehensive website, like a tribute website to their studio online. If you Google it, it'll be one of the first things that comes up. Golan Globus... It's an appreciation site, like really extensive newspaper articles, reviews, interviews with both of them and all the actors that were involved in their movies on a regular basis. It's good stuff.
I still remember getting, like, as a teenager going out when I was regularly picking up Variety. And I would go out and there'd be these special can issues of Variety, you know, when the Cannes Film Festival was going on.
Right.
And
yeah.
They'd be like 2 inches thick, you know. This issue would be like 295, and it'd be like two inches thick. And you'd open it up, and like seriously, 200 pages of it was just like ads for upcoming canon movies that never appeared, you know. And I was like, whoa, how could they be doing all of this stuff? And it'd be like full page ads for, you know, some version of, you know, Great Expectations with Al Pacino is, you know, in the lead or whatever, you know. He'd be like, what is happening? you know. Of course, you'd never see them. But some of them would pop up. They did a lot of really good movies.
I think it's a subject worth exploring at a future date. So when you attend this, I mean, save your stories, and then you can come on and be part of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Once I get my computer up and running, I will. I just found a photo of Terrence Malick on his new film set, directing Ben Affleck and Javier Bardem.
Wow.
Looks like Terrence Malick's wearing like a cowboy hat and blue jeans. He looks normal. Javier Bardem
sounds relaxed. I mean,
he's dressed like a priest, Javier Bardem. There's a film shooting in the Bartlesville area. Bartlesville is in Oklahoma, Terrence Malick country, that features Academy Award-winning movie stars Ben Affleck, Javier Bardem, and Rachel Weisz. That's about all that is known. What's unknown is what the movie is about outside of a nebulous description as a love story. Photos have surfaced that show Bardem and co-star Barry Pepper dressed as priests. The set is off limits to outsiders, and none of the secrets about the film are likely to be leaked. Rachel McAdams is also in the cast.
Wow!
This is basically an article from the Weekend Tulsa Entertainment magazine that talks about how secretive the project is and how they should be honored to have films shooting in their small town, which they are. The Bartlesville production is not accommodating any requests for interviews, says the director of the Oklahoma Film and Music Office. There's a story about Jeffrey Wells from Hollywood Elsewhere. He called Malick years ago, somehow found his number, and Malick was very polite to him and said, no, I'm not interested in doing interviews. I'm not interested in talking about any of my films. I think this was prior to Thin Red Line. So he's one of those reclusive guys.
Right.
Well, you just got to figure that maybe he just doesn't know what to say about his own movies, you know? Just got to figure that some people just don't know what to say, you know?
Yeah, and I guess if he doesn't feel the pressure to publicize his movies, he won't.
Right.
I'm sure most directors wouldn't if they felt like they had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it does give him kind of, because I've been thinking about this a lot with Kubrick, it does kind of give him a mythological kind of status. He's very mysterious, which enhances his films in a way,
mm-hmm.
Because you feel like some unknowable ghost is behind them. does that clutter our view of what the movies actually are, though? I mean, does that make us feel that the movies are more than they actually are? In Terrence Malick's case?
I don't know. What do you think, Jerry?
I
have opinions.
Well, here's the thing. I think the film should speak for themselves more than anything else. I don't know in this day and age how, well, Terrence Malick, I hope he's not on Twitter. The directors who are on Twitter should just stop it. Kubrick, I think the thing that made Kubrick, you know, the only thing that Kubrick regrets is he didn't make enough films. But I don't think he regretted ever not talking to the press or giving a lot of interviews or whatever.
He did feel in the later part of his life that it was unfortunate, all the rumors about him. And you heard this. He was prepared to go out and meet people and talk up Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, he was. That would have been interesting. But I think the problem today is we know so much about a lot of people that the mystique is gone. There was an era of mystique, mystery, and we don't have that as much anymore. Malick, I don't know that much about, but I hope it stays that way. I think this is a problem. What you do, whether it's music or film or books, that should always be the first thing. That should speak for you. If I know more about you, if your celebrity or your exploits are more than that, then it's not good. I think that's my own personal view of that.
So basically, what I agree with everything Jerry said. Basically, what we're saying is that the work comes first, and I think this is what Malick would say, and also what would get in the way of your enjoyment of the movie is if you did know more about him. So it's actually better that you don't. It might not be better at the box office because he still hasn't had a major hit.
Mm-hmm.
But for the work, where he does occupy that place that Kubrick did, where he's this guy that not only works in that secretive way, but also works in a way that is unencumbered by time. It's like the thing will be ready when it's ready. It's not, you know, it's not coming out until it's done. And I love that. I love that when I, you know, and he doesn't seem to have any kind of pressure on him at all from anybody. What was interesting about Kubrick was that it didn't matter how long he was going to take. The studios were going to be ready for him when he was ready. And so nobody was going to give him any crap for going 90 takes on something, you know, or working 5 years on a movie. It was just like, you know, the thing's ready when it's ready. And what that tells you when you're sitting down watching the movie, when the lights are about to go out, the movie's about to start, is that this thing's going to be good because I know this guy can make good movies, and he wasn't going to let it out until it was good, until he was satisfied with it. So, mm-hmm. you know, so that's what I think it's a good thing that he's like that.
Hmm. Well, his feeling is that Tree of Life, which they just released the poster for that. It's a big tree, the Tree of Life, with a ladder going up it. His feeling is that it's just as good as Badlands, that he's as proudest of this movie since Badlands.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
I don't know. I love I love The New World. I love Badlands the best.
Mm-hmm.
Days of Heaven is sumptuous, but dramatically kind of dead for me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't know. I mean, who do you idolize more? Do you idolize a guy that takes 20 years in between movies, or workhorse that rarely missteps like a Sidney Lumet?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, They're two different spectrums, and I don't know that because one is more mysterious and less productive than the other, that it means that you should idolize one more than the other.
Well, I don't think you should I mean,
I
think of it as something.
I don't think it should be a list or anything, you know. I don't think it should be a list, you know. It's just like, oh, one's good for one reason, one's good for another reason, and they're both equally good, you know.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's all right.
But, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah, you know, what's interesting about Malick is he's actually even more secretive than Kubrick is in a lot of ways, because even while Kubrick was alive, we knew a lot about him. We knew that he had two kids. We knew that he had a wife. Almost everybody who was interested in him knew that he was in England, and that and even knew the part of England that he was living in, and that and, you know, there were, you know, of course, wild rumors about him not wanting to be in cars or not wanting to fly, which both were true, at least the flying part, even though he did have a pilot's license. But, you know, I mean, like Malick, we don't know anything about him. Like,
No.
Who's waiting to get home for Terrence Malick?
I like that, Gene. I get that perfectly.
The next Wolverine movie will be called The Wolverine.
Okay.
Okay,
that's
The Wolverine.
The Wolverine.
That's like doing remaking Alien and calling it The Alien.
That's exactly what it is. Hey, you know what happened last night?
What?
What?
The Governor's Ball.
Yeah, tell us about it. Tell us, yeah.
The honorary Oscars, since they're not doing it during the broadcast, they're doing it as its own separate ceremony, and video clips are available online now of it. But among the honorees were Francis Coppola, Eli Wallach, Godard, Jean-Luc Godard, which was the most controversial point of the evening, since he refused to participate in the event, and he was known for his kind of anti-Semitic remarks in the past, even though they were quick to point out during the ceremony that none of these great films reflect those anti-Semitic sentiments.
What anti-Semitic remarks did he make?
Let's see.
No, please tell me. I'm
well,
curious.
I'm
curious too, but it's here. It's right here. Perhaps
I know
about
some of this stuff.
Perhaps the most delicate part of Saturday evening's exercise was dealt with first. That happened when a string of Academy governors rose to praise the work of Godard and, in effect, to explain their decision to honor him, a filmmaker who had been completely ignored by the Academy in the past and who repaid the favor with frequent jabs at Hollywood and with a pattern of pronouncements that left some claiming he was anti-Jewish.
You know, all right.
Well, you know.
Can I speak freely here for a second?
Okay, go ahead.
I'm Jewish. I get this, and I know exactly what he's saying, and it's not. I know you're all thinking, oh my God, it's like the Mel Gibson defense. Well, I don't have the Mel Gibson defense, but I understand the point he's making, and it does. It is a very leftist kind of, almost, I want to say, maybe borders on something else.
It's anti-Zionist.
More anti-Zionist. And I know people now, this is where I get into so much trouble, because as
of
I
course.
Am Jewish, I am also referred to as the most anti-Semitic Jew ever lived. And
you?
I don't mean to get the show into trouble when I say that, but it is true. I have been accused of that all my life. I now know what you're talking about. It is sort of like that anti-Zionist sentiment, but those films that he made, especially in the 60s, were some of the most extreme leftist films that you could see that really addressed what was going on in Vietnam, what was going on in Algiers, everything. I mean, just incredible stuff that you wouldn't see made today by American filmmakers. It was really just quite incredible to watch.
You know who proposed him for the honorary Oscar?
Who?
To begin with? Phil Alden Robinson.
Wow, okay.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He's head of the writers. Is he the head of the writers?
Who also has really derogatory things to say about ghost baseball players in cornfields, which I think that's a point of controversy.
That's fascinating, actually. In film socialism, I think, you know, in his newest movie, there was a lot of criticism leveled about the way that the Palestinians are being treated. And I think that's really the main issue with, you know, the main reason that he's being considered anti-Semitic is because he sticks up for the problems that the Palestinians are going through. And that's looked at by a lot of Jewish people as being, you know, anti-Jewish. So it's just like you got to be on one side or the other.
God, Dean, you have to lump us all together. I really,
I hate. Everyone thinks if you're Jewish that you're like, I don't know, but I understand what you're saying.
If you are pro-Palestinian, all right, people, you know?
Let me tell this true story. My older brother, none of us were ever bar mitzvahed. We never went to synagogue, but my older brother was. My dad took him out of Hebrew school. This is in the, I think, the late 60s or early 70s. He took both my older brothers out of Hebrew school because they asked my brother this question. This is in Sunday school. They asked him, well, if there are three Palestinians come to your door, would you give them water? And he's like, yeah, of course I would. Everyone went ballistic that you would do this. And so the rabbi called my dad down, and you don't start with my dad unless you want to get kicked in the face. You really don't. No, he's like Bob Hoskins in A Long Good Friday. Now he's like Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm, but he's also like Bob Hoskins in A Long Good Friday. I think he threatened to beat the shit out of the rabbi, and he took him out of school. He's like, fuck this. We're not doing this anymore. But that is something you bring up. It is, if God forbid you express any empathy or sympathy towards the Palestinians, it seems like you are automatically considered an anti-Semite, so...
That's the world we live in. That's the reason. That's really the reason, you know. And I mean, and again, you know, you mentioned his Algerian, thing about Algeria. Well, that was largely a Muslim uprising against the French, and he was sympathetic towards the Muslims, and that makes you, some people think that makes you,
I mean, it's really disgusting that we have this really narrow plane of thought that you can't, we have black and white, but we don't believe in gray, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
Anyway,
let's bring it back. Danilo
and Clint Eastwood were there to pay tribute to Eli Wallach, and then Francis Coppola, George Lucas was there for Mr. Coppola, and Eli's wife, Ann Jackson, who we tried to get for The Shining show and were unable, was there as well. Did you have a question, Dean? I'm sorry.
Well, also Kevin Brownlow. Can't forget Kevin Brownlow.
Yes, British film historian.
Great bio on David Lean. Great bio on him.
Who accepted that sound must inevitably come to film, but felt that it came too soon. I'm reading.
The way you said that is so funny. It's perfect.
I was uncertain as I was reading it. Am I reading this right? He was a the silent film aficionado of the silent film era, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
that's an interesting quote that he felt that it came too soon.
And it didn't end with a question mark as I read it.
You're like very Ron Burgundy-ish there.
Is anything else going on, Dean?
I'm sitting, since Unstoppable came out, I got into a little online debate with somebody about the merits of Tony Scott, and I said I hadn't really watched a Tony Scott movie since True Romance, because I just didn't like the director. Yeah, it's been that long. So they mentioned Man on Fire as being like a really good one, so I got it, and I'm in the middle of watching it, and I really like it. I think
it is a good one. It's really, I think that's their best collaboration personally, but
yeah, it's good. I'm
Unstoppable. Unstoppable is my favorite from theirs.
It's a good. It's
but, you know,
a damn
I also
good
like
one.
I also like Pelham. I mean, it's not what the original is. It doesn't have the character that the original.
It's a different vibe. It's a totally different vibe. It's a fun
but
movie.
I still like it. It's
a fun
it's
movie.
What it is. Yeah. It doesn't fail at what it tries to achieve.
No. I don't think so, but I mean.
I guess the only other, the only thing else that I'm trying to think of something else. I think I tried to sit and watch Domino, and then I just like had to run out of there after.
Yeah, I couldn't watch that either.
That was. I don't even think I was in there for 10 minutes. This was when I was working at a theater, and so
he does like orange, though, doesn't he? I mean, he's got a lot of orange in his movies.
I can't see a lot of orange, and it's a lot of blue in Man on Fire, it seems.
Oh,
but,
please. The fire itself is orange.
God, you guys have done something so horrible. You have no idea what you've done.
Everything's orange and auburn. And
No, not that. You made me just want to come out and defend why I like Domino. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Man.
Oh, damn you both to hell.
Is it because of the chick? Is that it?
What?
Is it because of the girl in it? Whatever it is?
Keira Knightley. No, she's great as Domino Harvey, but that's not what I was talking about.
Lori Petty?
What?
Lori Petty.
Lori Petty was great in Tank Girl. I like Tank Girl. Oh, never mind. We're not going to go there right now. I did that a couple of days ago. No, but it's written by Richard Kelly, and you see the seeds of this whole obsession with Lawrence Harvey and the Manchurian Candidate in that. It's there. I mean, I'm not saying it's a great movie. It's Tony Scott is obviously obsessed with the last 20 minutes of True Romance, and he wants to stretch it out for a two-hour movie or whatever. I'll be the first to tell you, it fails miserably. In that, it even playing some of the same music from the True Romance, the same songs and everything. But it does show this obsession that Richard Kelly has with Lawrence Harvey, the Manchurian Candidate, and stuff that would haunt the Box and Southland Tales. It's all there. I mean,
oh, that's right, because she was the daughter of Lawrence Harvey, right?
Yeah, I mean,
the real life character.
Yeah. No, it's a trashy film. I mean, a fun trashy film, but it is no doubt it's not a winner. I mean, I'm not saying that, but there's some stuff that's worthwhile to explore Richard Kelly's influences in that.
I think that's why I went in to take a look at it, as a matter of fact, because I saw Kelly's name on the poster, and I said, okay, well, I'll go and check it out, and then ran out of there immediately.
I understand. I can understand why you would not want to sit through it. I mean,
and Ridley Scott loves the smoke, man. I mean,
the smoke, the fog.
Oh,
the fog,
he loves that.
That rooms with blinds and the fog going through the rooms and that, thick light coming through the blinds.
Which is another thing that I liked about Someone Watch Over Me. It was like the film noir aspect of it. That was imposed upon it by the director, more so than inherent in the material, I think.
Right.
I thought it was a good, colorful effort.
That's a good movie. It's a good, respectable little. It's a little movie to me. It seems like a little Ridley Scott movie. Somehow.
Yeah. It's a little bitty movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. The only two things that I get I'm going to go to the movies, I think, on Wednesday. I'm going to go see a whole bunch of stuff. I don't know what I'm going to go see, but I feel like that going out to the actual theater. But the only other two major things is the article about SCTV that appears on the blog I did on I Do.
I love that show. That was such a funny show.
Yeah, it deals with television. It's called Flaming Nose. It's flamingnose.blogspot.com. And it's an article I've been meaning to do for a really long time. So I did a whole sort of love letter to SCTV. And
my favorite 3D movies of all time, Dr. Tongue, the 3D Stewardesses, and 3D House of Beef.
Yeah. And the 3D remake of Midnight Cowboy, Midnight Cowboy 2.
Those were great. That show was so ahead of its time. I mean,
it was. I mean, like in the article, I have a series of clips, and there's one that's two movie related ones. One is the K-Tel Fast Talking Theater with the host Harvey K-Tel, played by Harvey K-Tel, played by Dave Thomas, and it's a spoof. It's four fast-talking actors. One is Harvey Keitel, Broderick Crawford, Barbara Streisand, and Sandy Duncan in the fast-talking remake of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is pretty dang funny. And then there's the great Irwin Allen show, the Irwin Allen show, where Rick Moranis is producer Irwin Allen hosting his own talk show where all the guests get killed on camera. You know?
Yeah, that's right. I remember all of these.
Yeah. Anyway, that, and also David Thompson, you know, the British, I think he's British.
Yeah, he is. He's by the Biographical Dictionary of Film, and he's written, you know, The Whole Equation. I like a lot. I like that book a lot.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book, The Whole Equation. That's one of my favorite film books. He's got a fifth edition of the Biographical Dictionary coming out.
I'm not rich. I have two editions. I can't get another one.
Well, at any rate, he released to Ann Thompson of, she's with IndieWire.
Yeah, IndieWire, yeah.
Yeah, so he released a 50-question, a very tough 50-question trivia quiz for people to answer. And I guess so it's on her website, and I guess the deadline for answering is tonight at, like, 11:58 or whatever, and if you get all 50 right, you get a free copy signed by David Thompson of the thing. So I think I got all 50 of them right. I'm pretty sure I got all 50 of them correct.
Do you want a biscuit?
And I sent it in. Yeah, send me a biscuit.
Okay, I'll send you a biscuit.
But, hey, they're going. The rumor has it, in other news, that they're going to employ a female villain for the next Batman film.
I know. It's inspiring. Did you see that list of actresses?
No, no.
Oh, my God. Let me see if I can find it. I think Natalie Portman was it. Natalie Portman, Rachel Weisz.
Isn't Natalie Portman on the top of every female character list nowadays?
Dude,
it seems like it.
Probably. I mean, she wrote this raunchy comedy that she, I think, is going to star in, that everyone's making a stink about lately this week. So she's just all over the place. I mean, this is her idea.
Best actress this year is really going to be between her and Annette Bening, I'll tell you that right now.
Do you think Annette Bening is even – because I think Hilary Swank, because Conviction didn't do well at all. I mean, it's not even – it's like –
I don't think she's even part of the best actress conversation anymore. Although
I think Annette Bening must be relieved. Here it is. Here it is. Here's the list. Here it is. It's Anne Hathaway, Natalie Portman, Keira Knightley. Naomi Watts, Blake Lively, and Rachel Weisz are who he's meeting with.
Well, that's a, you know. I thought that Marion Cotillard was going to be in there since he just worked with her in Inception.
That's a good point.
I thought that that was sort of like a way to, like, for him to get warmed up with her so that she could be in the next Batman movie. But I guess, you know, if it's going to be a female villain, I mean, what are the other female villains besides Catwoman Batman?
It's going to be – I hope it's not Catwoman, because I think that's just – I don't think he's going to go that way. I think it could be the Demon's Daughter, which is the character that Liam Neeson played, and maybe Liam Neeson will come back because his daughter is a major part of Batman. I don't think it's going to be Harley Quinn. I just don't see that. Or it could be someone we've never heard of. It could be a brand new character.
That Devil's Daughter sounds like a, since it's going to be the third and final of the trilogy, right? So
yeah, I think it's the last Nolan one. I mean,
so that would make sense to bring it back around to the first one.
Yeah,
you know?
I would That'd like to see him bring Liam Neeson back for the third one. So
because he's in everything now, anyway.
Yeah. He's in that Russell Crowe movie the next 3 days.
Yeah, he pops
up.
And then he'll be the voice of the lion in the Narnia movie.
Yeah, I mean.
And then eventually Abraham Lincoln, whenever that happens.
Oh, I hope it does. My understanding is from a friend of Spielberg's is that Spielberg just completed work on War Horse.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in post-production on War Horse and 1010 at the same time, and apparently he's really, really high on War Horse. He thinks it's great.
It sounds that way.
Yeah, it's all done from the
perspective
of
the horse, yes.
Right? So it's
yes.
I don't think it's like horse cam, but
not unlike your average John Holmes film. So I think
it's going to be like Spielberg's Al Hazard Balthazar or whatever, you know, that Brisson movie.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Here's something, though. A friend of mine used to idolize Spielberg, and he feels that Spielberg's career and his choices have taken on a different trajectory now that he's not as excited about.
Well, it has. I mean, he's just matured into a different sort of filmmaker, you know?
Yeah.
He seems to be more interested in making movies about the world rather than making a world, you know, unto themselves in his movies, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, he seems to be more interested in doing history and stuff like that and that kind of thing.
What do you think, if you were to choose his top three best, Dean, what would they be?
Oh, God.
Top three best? Close Encounters, number one. It's really unfortunate. I'd love to put Schindler's in. I guess I'd have to, maybe I would, like, let Schindler and Saving Private Ryan, like, share a slot, because I really feel like somehow they're like images of the same kind of story, really, sort of. But they both have like major parts that I really hate, particularly the ending of Schindler and the kind of like the bookends of Saving Private Ryan. But and also, I guess I'd have to throw in E.T., really.
Throw in E.T. You got to really put that in there.
You know, but
what do you hate about the end of Schindler?
It's the stuff at Arlington Cemetery that I don't particularly like. You know, like the stuff with the older, you know.
That's
Private Ryan. That's Private Ryan.
Is that in Arlington or isn't that in Israel?
No,
you're
talking about Private Ryan.
Oh, Private Ryan.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were talking about Schindler.
No, we're talking about Private Ryan, yeah. Private
Ryan. I thought you were talking about Schindler. I was going to be like, where's Arlington coming in this?
Yeah, I can understand
Saving
Private Ryan. I can't understand the Schindler ending. What don't you like about Schindler?
No, I like that part where the real people are putting the rocks on Schindler's grave. That's cool. What I don't like
is
that's cool.
That's
cool.
Okay to bye-bye.
Well, you know what I mean. You know what
on the Blu-ray of Schindler, that I can see that being put on there.
That's very moving and apropos, and I particularly like the final shot of the rock coming in that you know is being put down by Liam Neeson, but you don't actually see it. It's Liam Neeson putting it down. I think that's really neat. But also, what I don't like is that very, very final scene of Schindler breaking down as he's going away from the factory and everybody has been presents him with the ring and all that kind of stuff. So it's just too much for me. You know, it just goes over that edge. But that seems like a minor point, really, to you know, bring Schindler down.
You don't believe that he'd be genuinely moved and that they'd say goodbye to him in that fashion?
I have one word for you, Dean.
In reality, what happened was that Schindler went away with diamonds located in the hubs of his wheels in the car. So no, I don't think I think it would have been more interesting if that particular emotion had been pulled back and we still saw Schindler as somebody who was moved but also who was still in there with his own self-interest and survival instincts intact. So I just thought that he should have dialed it back just a little, actually a lot more.
I can just see you getting that job as Spielberg's assistant on set. Jesus Christ.
I was never expected to get that job.
I know.
Well, I think he showed a real restraint throughout that entire film. But I mean, I would forgive him that. I mean, at every turn, I mean, he had a chess match between Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes that he cut out because it was too cinematic in a way.
That's really, I didn't know that. That sounds fascinating. I mean, of course, Schindler is a great movie, no question about it, one of the great movies of that decade and of all time, but it's just that one little bit. But to me, it's okay. It's not. It doesn't really, like, take anything away from the movie, really.
Yeah,
but
I think the thing about, and from my point of view, Schindler's, and especially about Munich, but there's that scene at Schindler's List when they're walking and, it's the war's ended, they've been liberated from the camp or whatever, and I think it is it a Russian officer on horseback, and he tells them, they don't like you down there, they don't like you there, they don't like you there. And it's the first time in the film, but also in Spielberg, where he's this level of honesty you don't hear, you would never hear in a high school history class or even a college history class, and it is breathtaking, because you're like, wow, that's the way I was kind of raised, and that makes perfect sense, and that's what makes Munich, I think, so powerful, too. There's a level of honesty that you don't get in an education that you hear there, and I really Schindler's List to me is just this bravado filmmaking, but also there's a level of honesty in there that you did not, with the exception, I think, of Europa, and the shop around the corner. Was it the shop around the corner or the shop on Main? The one. And,
the shop on Main Street.
The shop on Main Street that I'm thinking of. Sorry, you'll forgive me. So many shops and film titles. You'll forgive me. But it's this honesty that you don't see that often, especially in American cinema. And Schindler's List is really one of the first films to really go that way. Because I realized that the miniseries Holocaust was very important. I remember when that came on, and while that was important, it's not quite the same thing as Schindler's List. Schindler's List was this honesty that, not everyone saw, but more people saw than you thought would see it, and it's good. And then he comes back even further in Munich and delivers that further. So,
yeah.
Well, from the Holocaust to Michael Caine, you guys want to hear?
Let's go with Michael Caine, dude. Thank you, Jamie. That's what I love about you. You always bring us back down to reality here. Thank you.
You want to hear a scene from a BBC show? This clip is making the rounds now. It's a BBC show called The Trip. Stephen Coogan is in it, and he and a friend are at a table, and they're imitating Michael Caine. They're arguing about the proper way to do Michael Caine.
Oh, yes, definitely. Because Steve Coogan is hilarious.
Here you go.
Here
it is.
Well, broadsheet journalists have described my impressions as stunningly accurate.
Well, they're wrong. I've not heard your Michael Caine, but I assume it would be something along the lines of, "My name's Michael Caine."
That is where you're so wrong. And you can look at my live video for proof, because that's the very thing I don't do.
Do you, Michael Caine?
Okay. I say, "Michael Caine used to talk like this in the 1960s, right? But that has changed." And I say that over the years, Michael's voice has come down several octaves. Let me finish. And all of the cigars and the brandy, don't let me finish, can now be heard.
Okay.
I've not fucking finished. In the back of the voice, and the voice now. Well, I've still not finished the voice.
You're panicking.
Like you're about to bloody talk. Let me finish. Right, so, Michael Caine's voice now, in the Batman movies and in Harry Brown. I can't go fast because Michael Caine talks very, very slowly.
Right, this is how Michael Caine speaks. Michael Caine speaks to his nose like that. He gets very, very specific. It's very like that. When he gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed. It gets very specific. It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it, all right? You're not doing it the way he speaks. You're not doing it with the kind of... And you don't do the broken voice, but he gets very emotional. But he gets very emotional indeed. She was only 16 years old. She was only 16. You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off. That's my cocaine.
That's that beautiful.
Unbelievable genius. That is great.
I love
that.
Impressions. I'm a sucker for impressions.
That was great. I had no idea. That was wonderful.
Have you guys ever seen that Michael Winterbottom movie that came out a few years ago with Steve Coogan called
Tristan Shandy?
Yeah.
Story? Yeah, that's a very funny movie, man.
That reminds me of the beginning of that movie, you know, because it's really, you know, even though it's an adaptation of the old, you know, sort of postmodern book from the 1800s called Tristan Shandy, it's also a movie about the making of the movie of Tristram Shandy. So it opens up with Steve Coogan playing himself and another actor whose name escapes me at the moment sitting in the makeup chairs and sort of throwing barbs at one another, you know, about, you know, each other's talent and stuff. And that reminds me of that. But that was great.
Mm-hmm.
They both do a really great impression.
Yeah. You do any impressions, Dean?
No, not really. Do you?
I don't do any. Kelly McDonald was in that.
Oh, yeah, right, in Tristram Shandy.
Yeah.
I love Kelly McDonald. Yeah, I think Kelly McDonald.
I know you love Kelly McDonald. You've said it repeatedly on the show. I love her, too. Everyone loves her.
I love her in Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she's very good on that.
Yeah, she's good in that, yeah. I still haven't seen the Michael Keaton movie, the Merry Gentleman, that he directed and stars in with Kerry McDonald. That's on DVD now.
Too.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah, that's. I'm just totally in love with her.
Yeah,
any chance
to see Michael Keaton would be great. I love Michael Keaton.
I still can't believe that that's her in No Country for Old Men playing Josh Brolin's wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just whenever I watch that movie, I'm like, God, I just can't believe that's her. I really thought she was going to get an Oscar nomination for that role. I just thought.
It is her. I did a blood test. That is her.
Yeah. And you got to tell me how you get so close to these people, man.
Yeah.
Do you do any impressions, Jerry? I don't.
Thankfully, I don't. I mean, we've been on the air this long. Let's not try to destroy the show.
Yeah, but what about Jamie? Jamie, do you do any impressions?
I do some impressions, yes.
Really?
I do
really?
Pacino. I do Pacino better than anyone outside of Craig Gass that I've ever heard.
Huh. I guess you're not going to have – are you going to have to – I guess you've probably done it on the show before, and maybe I've heard it. But
no, I've never done it before.
I'll tell you another impression I do very well.
I do an impression of a talk show host about to end the segment so we can get to our interview for the night.
Yeah, really, what the people are paying us for. That's damn good, man. Let's go. I want to hear this. So
that's
all right.
Good stuff. All right,
Dean, Dino.
Well,
we're going to close the show with this. So it's,
okay.
You know.
All right. Well, so I'll see you guys later, and I'll tell you all about the Golden Globus thing.
Yes,
when
definitely.
Does that take place? November 16th, it starts?
It's November 19th through, I think, the 26th. And viewers are interested in it, or listeners, they can go to the film comment. I think it's www.filmlink.com, and go to the Walter Reed, click on Walter Reed Theater, and it'll show you all of the events, and you'll be able to find it that way.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you,
Dean.
Sounds
good. We'll talk soon, buddy.
All right. See you later.
All right. Good night.
Bud. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Our interview for this evening, Tanya Hamilton, is the writer-director of a new film called Night Catches Us. It's in limited release in theaters starting December 3rd, but you can get it right now on demand. The movie stars Kerry Washington and Anthony Mackie, two tremendous actors.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what it's about. It takes place in 1976. When complex political and emotional forces are set in motion, when a young man returns to the race-torn Philadelphia neighborhood where he came of age during the Black Power movement, it's a great drama and a great showcase for both Washington and Anthony Mackie, and as well as Tanya, who is a first-time feature writer-director, and this conversation runs about 16 minutes, focuses on the process that she underwent to bring her vision to life. So here's Tanya.
I know it was hard for you when I left, but it wasn't my fault. I had to go. You understand that? Now, whose fault is it now?
This is my home. I have roots here.
You're living in the past, Patricia.
Things have changed, Snitch. I'm in charge now.
I'm only here for a week, and I'll be gone.
And you think that changes things?
Nobody's forgotten what you did to Neil.
Ma. Marcus.
Was he a Panther?
Yeah.
It's Patricia.
If you don't have plans, you should come by. I can talk to them if you want me to. They listen to me.
I can take care of myself.
I know they pumped 16 bullets into my best friend on his information.
It wasn't Marcus.
I'm not the enemy. You still got a friend. They have lost their way. He's putting guns in the hands of children.
I don't give a damn who you used to be. Got my own plan.
You ain't got to answer no questions. You hear that, pig? You don't got to tell them nothing.
Some cats drove by. Shot out the back window. Kids walking around talking about the Vanguard.
That's not who we were. That's not what we did.
Don't come back here.
If you want to have a say about how things go around here, you have to stay.
The dark brown shades of my skin.
Not the life you want to live.
I want more for both of us.
Anthony Mackie and Kerry Washington with music by The Roots. Night catches us. Sometimes you can't go on until you go back.
I understand that this project took a while to finally get off the ground, something like 10 years of development. I'm wondering where it originated from. I wrote it in 99. I have a hard time being concise about where it originated. I mean, I think that maybe the best answer is that I am super interested in that sort of little section of time in African-American history. I think that there's something beautiful and romantic and tragic and just interesting about civil rights and about the transition into Black power. And there's something very human about all of it that I think I just not my history, but just I've always found it pretty fascinating. And I think that when I wrote this, I think I wanted to kind of do a very small, kind of simple story set to, kind of this larger backdrop. And to kind of look at these people in a really human way and kind of, at the same time, kind of have, build a world that kind of reflects some of the things I was really interested in about that time. So was this developed at the Sundance Lab originally? Is that what I read? It was, yeah. Okay. I took it there and to the writing and then eventually to the directing lab in 99. So when you have certain themes that you want to explore and you develop a story and characters around those themes, you've lived with this project for a long time. How did the project kind of define itself to you over the years? What were those different kind of, what was the evolution of it for you? I think it's a really great question. I mean, when I started writing it, I made a short, which was my thesis at Columbia, and about these two kids in Jamaica, where I'm from. And I think I was really interested in kids, and I was interested in kind of their world. I think back then, To Kill a Mockingbird was one of my favorite books. Not so much the politics, but I loved the world, and I loved the idea of a neighborhood and a block. I think that if I think back to my time, as a kid in this country, I think that I loved where I lived, and I have these fond memories of, my neighborhood and the people and the kids I knew. Like, I can't remember names or whatever, but just the essence of it. So, I think that's where a lot of my nostalgia kind of lies. And so initially when I wrote it, that's what it was about, not about me.
but it was about a kid, you know, the Irish character, and she was the main character, and she had two friends, and I think that it favored so much more in a way To Kill a Mockingbird set to the Banthers than anything else. And I then I think, you know, as the years went past, I think that the story really evolved, and I think that the Marcus character, who had always been there, and the Pat character, I mean, they were always in the background. I think that Iris faded, and I think they became more prominent. I think the love story really developed, you know, and I think sort of despite what I would have wanted, you know, I think I for a while tried to really kind of, you know, control it into being, you know, the story that it always was. But I think that, you know, Marcus really emerged as the main character. I think in many ways I changed a lot as a writer. And I think also, I think I had a lot of fear in a way, maybe early on, about writing adult characters. I didn't feel like I understood them well enough. I think that it was difficult to write characters that were complicated in ways that didn't feel, you know, flattering. So I think all of that. So I think it really had a pretty big evolution. Had I made it, you know, in 2000, I think it would have been a very different movie.
Right. Right. Well, that fascinates me, because when you're living with it for so long, I mean, I'm sure it's heartbreaking when you suffer kind of stops and starts along the way, but you have an opportunity to really refine it. But
right.
How does it become a different animal when you involve the other creative talents in the process?
I mean, I think that's the, you know, it's interesting. That's the nice part, because I think that, you know, the thing is that, like, you know, I try to kind of really embrace my deficits and my strengths. There are a lot of things I really suck at, and there are other things that I'm good at, you know, and I feel like I understand character and I understand world. And those are the two things that I spent a lot of time trying to learn how to do. I need to, like, figure out a million things more, but just on that scale of what one knows versus what one doesn't, those are the things that I can do. I think that there are a lot of other things that I can't do, and so what's nice is to have people come in who can do those things, and then it becomes this great collaboration. And I feel like, you know, I was definitely like that kind of kid who was like, let's all go to the bathroom together, you know, and like, that's great. And so I remain that person. So I kind of, you know, I like the togetherness part of filmmaking on the creative end. And, and that was nice. And, you know, so, and the cinematographer and I, you know, I think we were very like-minded. I think we are very like-minded, you know, visually. And so that was, you know, it was nice to kind of sit down and talk to someone, and I had definite ideas. You know, I knew that I really loved Fat City and you know, and The Deer Hunter, and I kind of, you know, thought a lot about, you know, how to frame the comings and goings, you know, whatever, like a la John Ford. And, you know, so all of those things I could say to him, but then he would then counter, you know, well, what about this? You know, what if we did it this way? Things I had never thought about, and I was like, yeah, that's really great, that's so smart. And similarly with the, you know, costume designer and with the production designer, I could tell them the colors I knew that I wanted. I knew that I wanted subtlety. I didn't want it to be the garish 70s. I wanted it to be people who were working class and working poor, who lived, you know, in relatively sort of, you know, basic sort of terms, you know, even the flashy guy in the neighborhood, you know. I think that there's an ordinariness that I was really looking for. And so, you know, so all of those things, I think I could kind of tell them what I wanted, but they all came back with 50 times more, you know, on the ideas. And so I think in that way, I think it's really the thing I enjoy the most about film. There are a lot of things I don't like about it, but that is, you know, to me, the best part is to kind of find these creative partners and riff off of one another. And so I think that the essence of the film never changed from what I wanted, but the details, I think, shifted, and that was nice.
Well, the film has a stunning look and a very palpable sense of period. it doesn't hit you over the head with the period. It just is. I mean, it's there, the marrow of the film. You get a sense of that time and place. But you're a painter. You're a painter of large canvases, I've read. How does that affect your approach to composition, do you think?
I think that, yeah, I mean, I think it's a big part of it. It's a big part of sort of, you know, kind of how I approach kind of everything, I think, in a way. And I think that Dave Tumblety, who's the cinematographer, I always, say that he's an aspiring visual artist, because he is. And so we had that sort of nice thing in common where, you know, we would talk about stuff in terms of art and two dimensions. And I think that, I mean, it affects it pretty deeply. I think that I think about the world in terms of color. I think about, you know, I'm a bad math person, but I, you know, I can sort of look inside of a room and think that's a beautiful red on that edge of the frame. Mm-hmm. And I love that. You know, I think that it's the same thing with the editor. You know, like I think if my precision is very sort of off, you're not a math brain, but I think that to me the great thing is that when you can have a partner and you can say, you know, here's the essence of what I'm looking for. You know, that there should be this, you know, that the room should be kind of blue and like, you know, remember whatever, cheesily, like in Hitchcock, you know, stupid example, but, you know, when, you know, Kim Novak shows up in the red dress, you know, I'd love to, how can we sort of achieve something like that? And we use a piece of red or, you know, just these very abstract kind of thoughts, you know, but I think that to then have somebody who's actually very much a math brain kind of come in and then say, yeah, well, here's how I think we can do it. And so I think that was a big part of, you know, our process. I would often sort of say, in essence, the things that I wanted visually. You know, we thought about that porch and how Marcus kind of comes into their world, but how ultimately he kind of in a very ordered way kind of leaves, you know, and frame him in the doorway. And, you know, I think that it's a big part of how I think. And sometimes I think, you know, I think there were some pieces, some parts of kind of making this film when I thought this was sort of this huge deficit, you know, that I learned as a painter that you construct and then deconstruct and then reconstruct. And I think that that was really the fundamental kind of language that I was taught in. And, you know, you make a painting, okay, but you have to look at it and take it apart. And only in taking it apart do you find the essence of what it is. And I think that my brain so works that way, for better or worse. And my short that I made is a lot like that, sort of it. Pieces and you know, and I remember kind of halfway through the editing process when a lot of things weren't working, you know, I just felt so upset at myself because I was like, why can't I make myself think differently? Why can't I create, you know, polished, cohesive, you know, thing? Why is it that I have to sort of rip this thing apart and constantly try to kind of put it back together? And, you know, and I think that, and it reminded me so much of my short, and I just was like, that's just, you know, such a shame. And I think it was misguided in a way because I think I didn't recognize actually that it is a strength very specifically because it's my language. It was my language as a painter, my language as a writer in many ways, and I think it's my language as a filmmaker, and it just is. And so, you know.
Well, it's your process. It's your artist process, and it works for you, this film. What did you learn about yourself in the process of bringing this movie to life?
I mean, I learned things that I think I already kind of knew. You know, I love the exponential growth of the world when it comes to the creative part, but I don't love the other stuff. You know, too many people in film. As a painter, you know, I always try to say that you're really encouraged to have a lot of internal silent internal time. Mm-hmm. And I spent, you know, from the time I was in high school till I, you know, well into adulthood, living that kind of life. Just I don't do well with like trillions of people. And so that was something I didn't want to admit it. I fully can admit it now. And so that's one part. I think the other part is that it's a complete contradiction, because I think that I love the collaborative process of film. You know, that creative collaborative process I think is extraordinary, and is so nice. And when you can build a family and work with that family, I think that's pretty great. I think that, I think I learned that my non-math brain can sometimes be a bit of a deficit. You know, I think that as a writer, I think that, I made a lot of creative or sort of narrative leaps because I'd lived with the material for so long. Yeah. So that things kind of, A, B, C, I had sort of, without really recognizing that I needed it, I had taken out B, if that makes any sense at all.
Right.
And I sort of lived in that A and C, and then I think when I got to the editing room, I recognized that we needed B and I didn't shoot B. I think that as a writer, I learned, I think in many ways probably the most, I think as I work on my next project now, I see the fundamental things that I, of course, know as a screenwriter. You know, everybody learns the math, but I think, I think those things can kind of sink away a little bit when you know your characters too well,
right.
Your world too well, and you take for granted everybody else is going to be in that same position. So I think that, those are some of the things that I think. I think I approached directing with a great amount of fear initially. Because I think that I spent a lot of time writing, so I don't have a lot of fear. I can freely admit my deficits and I'm cool with all that. I think as a filmmaker, as a director, I think I was racked by a tremendous amount of fear and feeling, can I do a good job? And oh my God. And I think, ironically, I think it's sort of, it's the one piece that I realized that I'm not as bad at as I thought. And meaning simply that that I can speak to people, and that directing, there are many things that one needs to know as a director, but I think there's a fundamental thing, which is communication.
Yeah.
And that is something that's so inherent to just being people. And I think I kind of recognize that I can actually communicate with people. I have to learn, still more of the other stuff, but I think it's kind of like realizing that you can actually walk. Oh, okay, I can do that.
Yeah, so. But isn't it odd, and I'll let you go, but I just wanted to ask, isn't it an odd kind of dichotomy, though, that you spend so long developing it and nurturing it, and then when you finally get to do it, you're racing the clock? I mean, you have such a short window of time to actually create the actual film. I mean, that.
Yeah, it's true. And we had 18 days, so that was not fun. I think the thing is that, like, you definitely have this short window and you are rushed all the way through. But I actually think that, and I would imagine the more one does it, the more you sort of get better. But that I think you learn to kind of think on your feet better. I think that, you learn to kind of compensate. You learn to sort of be a lot more creative, because in that short window you have to make stuff work. And you learn to let go, and to kind of be cool with stuff. And so that's, I think those are all good things.
Okay, that is Tanya Hamilton. She's the writer-director of Night Catches Us, starring Anthony Mackie and Kerry Washington. You can see it on demand right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can. I'm going to try to watch it in the next couple of days.
Yeah, and it'll also be in limited release December 3rd.
Oh, December 3rd? Oh, that's when Black Swan is supposed to open here. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Man, that interview ended in mid-bite. I was trying to swallow my food.
Okay.
Nothing but professional on this show.
Dude, we're professional. Dude, you always do a good job. I don't think people are aware how hard you work on this show. I mean, you do everything, man. You're the man.
Well,
you can afford any interview on mid-bite, okay?
Gosh, we didn't even get a chance to talk about Jessica Simpson being engaged. We ran out of time. Darn it.
I had no idea. She never sent
letters
anymore.
That'll be like our Matt Damon. That'll be our Matt Damon on Jimmy Kimmel's show. Like, we'll always run out of time before we're able to talk about Jessica Simpson. All right. Wednesday night, a good show. Olivia Williams, terrific actress from Ghost Rider, and a lot of great other movies. Dave Foley, a great comedian from The Kids in the Hall and the News Radio, and a great series.
That's right, News Radio, yeah.
Yeah, comedic efforts. He'll be on to talk about Cooper's Christmas and a bunch of other projects that he's involved in. And then next week, Mike Lee Ensemble, Leslie Manville, and Jim Broadbent, because he can. I always think of that with Moulin Rouge when I think Jim Broadbent.
That's right.
All right, for those of you that missed it, we're going to close the show tonight with a little sneak preview of our upcoming Kubrick series. Topped off by our theme from Michael McCormick, who is now on Facebook, composer extraordinaire. Look him up. He's the Movie Geeks United film composer.
He's awesome.
And befriend him. We love him.
Mm-hmm.
Be his friend.
Really, be his friend.
All right. Thank you, Jerry.
Yeah, thank you. This was a lot of fun, man, as always.
And I will chat with you Wednesday. Let me find this file. Do I have the? Okay. There's
I hope
file.
You have it. It should be there in the switchboard.
I wanted to close tonight's show with something else.
You could do that. You could.
It just occurred to me. This will be a little teaser for our next show. I'll play this really softly. There is a pop song that I've had in my head. I have no idea why. For the past couple of weeks, so I finally bought the thing, and uploaded it. So we could play it on the show. Here's a little taste of it. You'll get the whole thing on Wednesday.
All right.
Come on, Jerry. Get up and dance. Come on, man.
Oh, yeah. You know I want to, huh?
All right. You'll hear the full thing on Wednesday night. If that's not a teaser, I don't know what is. He's still around, Billy Ocean. He's still kicking, man.
I think, yeah.
No. All right. All right, guys. It's been a good night. Thank you. See you Wednesday.
See you Wednesday, everyone.
Bye-bye. Matthew Modine on Working with Stanley Kubrick.
I felt like I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't know how to play this character that Stanley Kubrick was giving me an opportunity to play, and I knew it was a really important film. I knew this was a really difficult character, maybe the most difficult character I'd ever played, and I was wandering around in a field, and I saw Stanley driving across it in his Jeep, and I tried to hide in the grass so he wouldn't see me, and of course he did, and he drove across the field and drove up and said, hey, you know, jump in, I'll give you a ride to the set. And I said, no, it's okay, I'll walk. And he could see that I was disturbed and upset, and he said, what's wrong? And I said, well, Stanley, I don't know how to play this role. I don't know what you want from me. I don't know what I'm doing. And he shut the Jeep off, and he pulled on his beard, and he scratched his forehead, and he said, listen, I don't want you to play anything. I just want you to be yourself. And I said, yeah, sure, Stanley, okay, yeah. I'll just be myself. And he said, jump in the Jeep. I'll give you a ride to set. I said, no, it's okay. I'm gonna walk. And he drove off, and I wrote in my diary that I know the important part of that sentence was to be.
I think I was trying to suggest something about the duality of man, sir.
The what?
The duality of man, the Jungian thing, sir.
Whose side are you on, son?
You can hear the rest of Matthew Modine's interview on the Kubrick series, the Movie Geeks United in-depth 8-part tribute podcast dedicated to the films of Stanley Kubrick, airing Sunday, December 5th through December 12th.